From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The Israelis should respect our areas. And if they are entering everywhere, bomb everywhere, killing the civilians, children, women, and etc., I think this will lead for more Palestinian reactions. And when this criminal prime minister in Israel, Sharon, when he decided to assassinate or liquidate any leader, he decided how many Israelis will be killed in the same time.
Marwan Barghouti, the so-called leader of the Second Intifada, the secretary general of Fatah's military wing in the West Bank, captured by the Israeli military, will hear portions of a rare interview with him. As the world's attention remains riveted on the occupied territories, the war in Afghanistan rages on. We'll talk to the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, reporter Robert Fisk. Then paying for the Taliban's crimes, abuses against ethnic Pashtuns in northern Afghanistan.
In almost all of the northern provinces of Afghanistan, ethnic Pashtuns, who are the largest single ethnic group in Afghanistan but a minority in the north, have been systematically looted, frequently detained and extorted, and in some cases even subjected to rapes and summary executions.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State General Colin Powell ended his Mideast mission today without clinching a ceasefire or a clear-cut agreement by Israel to withdraw its troops from the Palestinian areas. As Israeli troops invade two more villages today, Powell said the Israeli pullback is underway. He also said Ariel Sharon had assured him Israeli forces would be pulled back from West Bank areas by the weekend. But Sharon recently announced troops would remain in Ramallah and Bethlehem for an indefinite period. Powell spoke after a two-hour meeting with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. After the meeting, Arafat accused Sharon of reoccupying the West Bank after promising to pull back. The Palestinian information minister said the Powell-Arafat meeting was catastrophic. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak promptly canceled a scheduled meeting with Powell in Cairo. Powell will instead meet with Egyptian and Jordanian foreign ministers before returning to the U.S. In Bethlehem, Palestinians are accusing the Israeli army of attempting to storm the Church of the Nativity last night after heavy gunfire broke out. The army has been besieging some over 200 people who took sanctuary in the church 2 weeks ago. Yesterday, Israeli troops took over the Bethlehem Star Hotel, where most foreign journalists stay. A reporter for the Palestine Independent Media Center said the troops have taken over the entire top floor of the hotel, where journalists had been filming the army's siege of the church. We turn now to the Church of the Nativity. We go inside to Tony Salmon, who is with the Antonian Charitable Society, a Roman Catholic institution in Bethlehem, inside Church of the Nativity in Manger Square. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tony Salmon.
Yes.
Can you speak up as loud as you can and tell us what is happening now at the Church of the Nativity?
Now, at the Church of the Nativity, after 16 days of siege, there is a big catastrophe will be if the situation continues like this. Today, a boy of about 16 years old went out from the church to the garden of the church, looking for some green food, which is a nature food that is growing on naturally. To have some, we call it in Arabic, khubbeza, I don't know the meaning of in English, but it's green food that we eat, and it's a natural food, or natural grass. And the Israeli saw him, and they shot him. He was injured, one was in his leg, near his knee, and another one in his back. He's bleeding since 2 hours, and till the moment nobody can give him more than the first aid that is available inside the church.
We're hearing different reports of what has happened to the church in the last 24 hours. Has the Israeli military raided any part of the church at this point?
Yesterday night at about 6:30 local night PM, according to the local time in Bethlehem, the Israeli beginning shooting toward the Church of the Nativity from several sides, and it was for about 40 minutes. As a result of that, there was a room inside the Greek Orthodox convent burned, and the other one was damaged. After that, after 40 minutes of shooting, they stopped, and before midnight, there was a sound, hard sound, going around maybe for 2 to 3 hours, shouting around the church. After that, after midnight, everything was quiet, and it continued quiet till this morning when the small boy, this guy went out. His name is Sa'er Manasra, went out to the garden of the church looking for some food, and he was shot by the Israeli, and he is wounded and bleeding since 3 hours, let's say.
Are there negotiations going on between the Israeli military?
No, there is no negotiations. It was arrangement for having a meeting yesterday, but everything was failed for the obstacles that the Israelis put in front of the Palestinian Committee. And one of these obstacles that they did not want to declare where is the place of the meeting. They want to take the committee to a place that nobody knows. And second thing, to bring any third party to take these people from their houses to the meeting place. So it was dangerous to go, and nobody went. So the meeting did not held, and after that everything was stopped, and we don't know tomorrow what will happen.
Tony Salmon speaking to us from inside the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. The Israeli military has taken over the hotel, the Star Hotel, where journalists have been filming what is going on in Manger Square. It's the highest building in Bethlehem. We will continue to get reports from the church. Washington's support for Israel remains strong, but Israel's standing with most other countries, the UN and international aid workers, slumped to its lowest point in 20 years yesterday amid condemnation of the Israeli army's actions in the Jenin refugee camp. There were repeated calls for a United Nations-led inquiry into allegations that the Israeli army carried out a massacre and that its soldiers are guilty of war crimes. In a House of Commons debate in Britain, prominent Jewish MP Gerald Kaufman said he's a lifelong friend of Israel, but he said, quote, Sharon has ordered his troops to use methods of barbarism against the Palestinians. It is a time to remind Sharon that the Star of David belongs to all Jews and not to his repulsive government. His actions are staining the Star of David with blood. The Jewish people, whose gifts to civilized discourse include Einstein and Epstein, are now symbolized throughout the world by the blustering bully Ariel Sharon, a war criminal implicated in the murder of Palestinians in the Sabra and Shatila camp and now involved in killing Palestinians once again. Again, that comment from a Jewish member of the British Parliament, Gerald Kaufman. British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw said rules on weapons exports to Israel are to be tightened after British-made military vehicles were spotted attacking Palestinian villages. An aid worker who was finally able to enter the devastated areas of Jenin refugee camp called the site absolutely unbelievable and a humanitarian catastrophe. Israel had until yesterday refused aid workers access to the camp. A senior UN official commented, I have not met one person in the international community who had any other explanation for this refusal other than the fact that they're hiding a war crime, in fact, two war crimes, the mass killing and the denial of humanitarian relief. In an eerie resemblance to how companies counted their dead in the World Trade Center attacks, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees will be matching the names of all surviving refugees with its previous list of camp residents to try to establish the number of dead. The task is expected to take months. This news from East Timor. Independence leader Xanana Gusmão has been named the winner of East Timor's first presidential election, a major milestone after the quarter of a century Indonesian military occupation that killed more than a third of the Timorese population. The territory of 800,000 will become the world's newest independent country on May 20th. Democracy Now! Will be there bringing you reports. And the Bush administration yesterday admitted that the Assistant Secretary for Western Hemisphere Affairs, Otto Reich, phoned Venezuelan coup leader Pedro Carmona the very day he took over as interim coup president. A State Department official claimed the call was to plead with him not to dissolve the National Assembly on the grounds it would be a stupid thing to do and would provoke an outcry. The disclosure raises questions as to whether Reich or other officials were stage managing the takeover by Carmona. A day earlier, senior administration officials admitted they recently met several times with coup leaders and were briefed on the situation. A Defense Department official said, quote, "We were not discouraging people. We were sending informal, subtle signals that we don't like Chavez."
I've been accused and convicted. I've been objected and selected. But now I decide to stand for the right. Weathering morning, noon, or night. Just let me have some water. I'm thirsty to be free. Can't you speak my mind first? 'Cause only freedom is my turn. I know that freedom is my turn. I woke it, woke it, woke it, woke. So many days I've been locked in a cell, and this living here seems worse than hell. Just set me free out of captivity.
Gregory Isaacs, jailer, here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. On Monday, Israeli soldiers captured one of the leaders of the Palestinian Intifada, Marwan Barghouti, secretary general of Fatah in the West Bank, a close aide to Yasser Arafat, member of the Palestinian Legislative Council. Detained at a house in Ramallah, Barghouti's fiery speeches and frequent media interviews, including several he gave Israeli television in Hebrew, earned him the title the leader of the Second Intifada. Marwan Barghouti was arrested for the first time when he was 18. He learned Hebrew in Israeli prisons. He served 6 years in prison for membership in Fatah when it was an illegal organization. He was deported in 87, allowed to return 7 years later under an interim Palestinian-Israeli peace deal. In the months preceding his capture, Barghouti had gone almost completely underground. He hadn't left Ramallah for 19 months for fear of being detained or killed. An Israeli missile attack on his convoy narrowly missed him in August of last year. Last December, his house was stormed by Israeli soldiers in apparent retaliation for an attack on a bus of Jewish settlers days before. We're joined on the telephone right now, before we go to a rare interview with Marwan Barghouti himself, by Tufik Haddad, Palestinian-American editor of Between the Lines, and Allegra Pacheco, who is an Israeli-American lawyer. Let's start with Tufik Haddad. Can you tell us about the significance of the arrest of Marwan Barghouti?
Yeah, well, Marwan very much is a symbol of the radicalism, or rather the sort of awakening consensus amongst Palestinian society, in particular within the Fatah party itself, which, if we'll recall, during the years of the peace process years, was very much the cornerstone to protect the peace process, as these are the people who were taken en large into the Palestinian Authority security forces, and these were the people who were supposed to keep things together so that the opposition to the peace process would be somewhat liquidated or kept in check, at least. So when Marwan Barghouti very much represents the transformation that took place within the Fatah party and the mainstream Palestinian nationalist faction that slowly awakened to the treason of the peace process, that what it was, in fact, was not a peace process at all, but was a reorganization of the Israeli occupation, was continual stall tactics by Israel in the negotiations, of course, beneath the banner of the peace process, but while all along Israeli colonial and occupational practices would continue vis-a-vis, of course, the building of settlements. You had over half the settlements that are on the West Bank and Gaza Strip today were built during the era of the peace process, and various other things related to the Oslo Accords that were not implemented by Israel, including transfers of land that were supposed to be transferred over to the Palestinian Authority, as well as prisoner releases. These sort of things, most especially, of course, the settlement issue, very much eroded popular Palestinian faith in the peace process. And Barghouti, who formerly was a very vocal supporter of the peace process and with parts of the Israeli left, gradually very much symbolized this transformation that took place, and to the point where they felt that the peace process no longer harbored any opportunity or potential for bringing about a just resolution to the Palestinian plight and recognition of their national rights as protected by international law and UN resolutions. So he was probably the most outspoken spokesperson for this cause, particularly because he came from the mainstream factions, because we must also recall that he was an elected official from the Ramallah region. He was also a well-known popular student leader during his time in Bir Zeit. So he comes from this background that sort of is very mainstream. Palestinian nationalism by no means could ever be considered sort of extremist, centrist politics, but very much symbolizing that, like, even the way Israel conducted itself during the peace process years was enough to, like, make the mainstream of Palestinian nationalism have no faith that the peace process and the way Israel is running the negotiations and the way the American administration was protecting Israel and not making them abide by the agreements or stop settlement expansion for that matter, that they felt that there was no longer any hope in this track. So the arrest of Marwan is very much sort of this attempt by the Israeli administration to sort of, gain this sort of victory by imprisoning a political leader of the Intifada, its most eloquent and outspoken spokesman.
We're also joined on the telephone by Allegra Pacheco, who is an Israeli-American lawyer representing Palestinian political prisoners in the West Bank and Gaza. In 1999, she litigated and won the first anti-torture case before the Israeli High Court. The Israeli government, Ariel Sharon, says Marwan Barghouti will be charged with mass murder and brought before an Israeli court. What is your response to that?
Well, I think that's a lot of hype at the moment, because generally when a Palestinian is arrested, he's usually interrogated by the Israeli security services for 2 to 3 months. And only if there's evidence afterwards in a confession can the Palestinian be charged in an Israeli military court. And as I understand, Marwan Barghouti is now under interrogation. So I think we have some time to see if there will be any real physical or legal evidence available to even charge him. Otherwise, I think that he'll be sent to administrative detention, which is the Israeli option for putting people, Palestinians, in prison when they don't have evidence to charge them. And that's usually done with a military order imprisoning the Palestinian for 6 months without charges or trial.
What about the significance of the place he holds within the Palestinian leadership and the arrest of that level of Palestinian leader, Allegra Pacheco?
Well, I think as Taufik indicated, he has he's a popular leader. He's an elected official of the Palestinian parliament. I mean, the Israelis have arrested a Palestinian parliament member. They've gone into foreign land and arrested a foreign official. I think in any other place in the world, this would be outrageous. I'm not sure, I think for the Israeli public, and especially for Sharon, he needs to prove that all this killing and massacring and destruction was worth something. And Marwan Barghouti has been built up by the Israeli media, especially, and by the government as a leader of the Intifada. And so therefore, by arresting him, Sharon can justify, I put that in quotations, to the Israeli public what he's done in Jenin and what he's done throughout the rest of the West Bank. But I don't think that this I would say, the fanfare about surrounding Marwan Barghouti's arrest will last very long and give Sharon continued support. I think, you know, as time goes on and more information comes out about Jenin and Nablus, and as the sieges continue in Ramallah and Bethlehem and in other places, and more abuses continue, I think that will also begin to erode the support for Sharon's operation.
Tufik Haddad of Between the Lines, Palestinian-American editor. I'm looking at a piece from the Voice of America talking about Barghouti, saying he was arrested not far from Arafat's headquarters, head of the Fatah movement in the West Bank, and allegedly behind scores of attacks against Israelis. He is a top militant leader and an outspoken supporter of using violence as a tool during the current conflict, although he's not admitted to being directly responsible for planning attacks. Your response to that?
Well, I mean, Marwan openly says that he's not a pacifist, but that doesn't mean that what he would say, and most Palestinians would agree with him, in fact, all that I would know, would say that he believes in the right of Palestinians to resist occupation. He's very clear about this. I mean, he openly states that he is against attacks inside the Green Line, as in what is recognized as Israel proper. But everything within the boundaries of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which is regarded as occupied territories, is especially by way of Israeli military installations and is a viable target, because and this is very much the principles of on which you know the Second World War and the resistance against the Nazis in occupied Europe, the situation that was going on there. And so he says he's not a pacifist, but like he also believes in the right of Palestinians to resist, which is only the most it's an elementary human right, given the fact that the Palestinian occupation is 35 years old, that it's been internationally recognized as illegal, that the Israeli settlement practices are illegal, and everything else they do by way of uprooting trees, to confiscating land, to taking prisoners, to building settlements, to taking the water, to taking the agricultural lands, taking stone quarries, all this is illegal practice. So and given the fact that Palestinians feel that they've tried, literally tried, and knocked at every doorstep, including, you know, the UN and all the international fora that they need to go through to try and enforce the implementation of an Israeli withdrawal from these territories, Palestinians, no one has the right to tell the occupied that they don't have the right to resist the occupation. And that's why Barghouti very much symbolized this. As far as him being personally responsible, I mean, I don't think they have very much credit at all. These claims or accusations don't have very much credit. He's a political leader. He's an elected official. He's certainly not the type of fellow who will go out and, you know, he's not actively involved in shooting confrontations or anything of that sort. The eloquence of what he says, and that he comes from the center Palestinian nationalist faction, makes him so threatening, because this was the quote moderate camp within the Palestinians, the people who were said, okay, we are accepting of a two-state solution, we will accept that Israel was created on 78% of Palestinian of historical Palestine. All we are asking for is 22% of our land and the implementation of UN resolutions, which have consistently been passed through the General Assembly and Security Council.
Tufik Haddad, I want to thank you for joining us. So we're going to go to break. When we come back, we're going to go to an excerpt of the rare interview with Marwan Barghouti. Tufik Haddad, Palestinian-American editor of Between the Lines, Allegra Pacheco, Israeli-American lawyer, joining us from Israel. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
And flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that weave, but now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many down, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds.
Both Sides Now, Joni Mitchell, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to a rare interview with Marwan Barghouti. He is currently being interrogated by the Israeli military. They arrested him on Monday night. Israeli border police using night vision binoculars, radar, and camouflage soldiers have captured Marwan Barghouti. They accuse him of leading the 18-month-old Palestinian uprising. This interview was conducted by Raphael Kraft of Free Speech Radio News at an undisclosed location before Marwan Barghouti was arrested.
From the first day, our strategy in Fatah and the Tanzim to concentrate our struggle in the occupied territories. And we call everybody to prevent any kind of attacks inside Israel. We do believe it's preferable to continue the struggle in the occupied territories and to targeting the Israeli occupation, including the settlers. I think this is the strategy. And I hope that Hamas and Islamic Jihad and all the groups will concentrate their struggle against the occupation here. But when the Israeli are continue in their massacres, assassinations, destroying the Palestinian headquarters and etc., I think this was the result of that lead Hamas and others to attack the Israelis inside Israel. I hope that they will concentrate the struggle and the attacks against the Israeli occupation inside the occupied territories. But I think it's very difficult to keep this strategy when the Israeli are continue to bombing the Palestinian cities under the Palestinian Authority control, because the Israeli should respect our areas. And if they are enter in everywhere, bomb everywhere, killing the civilians, children, women, and etc., I think this will lead for more Palestinian reactions. And when this criminal prime minister in Israel, Sharon, when he decided to assassinate or liquidate any leader, he decided how many Israelis will be killed in the same time.
You seem to have distanced yourself from Mr. Arafat in the last few months, especially since the 11th of September attack, and concentrated your work more with the Islamic and national movement.
I am working with all the groups, with my people, and I have, as I told you, good relation. We respect Mr. Arafat. He is our historical symbol for the Palestinian struggle, and we respect him, and we are trying to help him, and etc. There is no any kind of problem, especially in political situation. Sometimes we have our criticism for Mr. Arafat in the performance, internal performance, and the administrative situation, and etc. But politically, we support him.
When the Palestinian Authority had launched its wave of arrest of PFLP members, you went in the street with your men, shooting in the air. Was it a provocation toward Mr. Arafat?
Yeah, I don't think, you know, that I don't accept any kind of this Palestinian arrest for anybody. I don't accept it. I am against that, and I try to do my best. There is no anybody who can justify this arrest for these people who are, I consider all these people are freedom fighters, mm-hmm. including the Popular Front. And I don't think that they did any kind something wrong. They didn't do that.
So why Mr. Arafat doesn't arrest you if you go out in the street and you say you see him every day? In the meantime, you go in the street and you show off?
Yeah, it's not easy for him. I'm the leader of Fatah Tanzim in the West Bank, yes, of course. And I have a power in the street. And also I am a parliamentarian. I'm a member of the Legislative Council. He needs a process of judicial process to arrest me. He need two-thirds of the voters in the seats in the legislative council. So it's very difficult for him to do that. I think that always the resistance will continue. If there is an occupation, it will continue. Never they can achieve security by tanks, by force, by assassinations, by closure, by these things. So I do believe that the resistance will continue. The Palestinians are patient enough, and they know very well that this is long fighting. It's not for 1 month or 2 months or 1 year or 2 years. It will take long time, so they should be patient and keep their power.
Marwan Barghouti, he was arrested on Monday night. This interview was conducted several months ago by Free Speech Radio News reporter Raphael Croft. You are listening to Democracy Now! As the world attention remains riveted on the occupied territories, the war in Afghanistan is raging on. Just yesterday, Britain announced it's launched a major military offensive in the eastern mountains of Afghanistan, joining U.S. and Afghan forces already deep in the region. Last month, the U.S. launched Operation Anaconda in Afghanistan. It was the largest U.S.-led ground offensive since the Gulf War. It lasted 12 days. Smaller assaults have continued throughout the past few weeks. According to CNN, fierce firefights erupted over the weekend between U.S. soldiers and alleged al-Qaeda forces. Meanwhile, the press has also been reporting increased fighting between rival Afghan factions. Last week, the forces of an interim government commander and a royalist warlord clashed just west of Kabul, exchanging fire and killing at least three people. The fighting followed days after an assassination attempt in Jalalabad against Defense Minister Mohammad Fahim. He survived the attack, but five others were killed and 50 were wounded. Just a week earlier, the Afghan government announced it had unearthed a plot to kill the interim leader, Hamid Karzai, and the ex-king, Zahir Shah. The government publicly blamed the Taliban and al-Qaeda for the plot, but also cast suspicion on a former prime minister and several powerful warlords. At least 160 people have been arrested in connection with that. Well, the mounting instability in Afghanistan comes as the country begins the complicated and lengthy process of choosing a new government. On Monday, Afghans across the country began selecting representatives for the Loya Jirga, or Grand Council, that will convene in June to choose the new leaders of Afghanistan. But the rising tide of internal violence is threatening that. Many are concerned that the Loya Jirga could be severely undermined. There has been a report that was just released by Human Rights Watch that describes a post-bombing Afghanistan racked by instability and factionalism. We go now to one of the researchers at Human Rights Watch.
I'm Vikram Parekh. I'm a researcher covering Afghanistan at Human Rights Watch. I just recently returned from a field mission to Afghanistan with a few of my colleagues where we were looking into abuses against ethnic Pashtuns across northern Afghanistan. What we found was that in almost all of the northern provinces of Afghanistan, ethnic Pashtuns, who are the largest single ethnic group in Afghanistan but a minority in the north, have been systematically looted, frequently detained and extorted, and in some cases even subjected to rapes and summary executions. The effect of these abuses, which began with the collapse of the Taliban, a mainly Pashtun movement, was to displace thousands of ethnic Pashtuns, mostly internally within the north, but increasing numbers moving towards the south and towards Pakistan. The problem that we documented is an ongoing one. I think our most immediate recommendation is actually to the authorities in the Afghan interim government. All of the major parties in the north are implicated in the abuses against the Pashtuns, and we're calling on their forces and the commanders responsible to immediately cease the violations against the Pashtun community in the north. We're calling on the international community to promote security for civilians in northern Afghanistan, irrespective of ethnic origin, by expanding the International Security Assistance Force, which is presently limited to Kabul in numbers, under less than 6,000 troops. And we're also calling for support for judicial mechanisms and mechanisms that could begin to address some of the underlying grievances between different ethnic communities in the north over land, livestock, and other movable property. I think we're definitely seeing a reversion to the conditions that prevailed in 1992. I mean, there's a large proportion of the country, probably the majority at this point, has been partitioned off between rival armed parties or rival warlords. And there's acute conflict between them. While we were there in February, I think there were about three separate occasions where there was serious tension and armed conflict between the two main parties in the north, both south and east of Mazar-e Sharif, the major regional city. So this is something that is, unfortunately, playing out in conditions of great insecurity for civilians. And Kabul has been spared from that in a way, only because of the presence of international security forces.
That is Vikram Parash, who is with Human Rights Watch. He just came out with a report. Human Rights Watch just came out with a report on the ethnic fighting in Afghanistan. We turn now to Sonali Kohatkar, who is vice president of the Afghan Women's Mission. Now she is with Pacifica Station KPFK, morning show host and co-producer, and has an upcoming article in the Berkeley Women's Law Journal on the impact of U.S. intervention on Afghan women's rights. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sonali.
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. I'm looking at the front page of the Washington Post today. The two top stories, British forces lead new Afghan mission on one side, and the U.S. concluding bin Laden escaped a Tora Bora fight, failure to send troops in pursuit termed major error. Not clear whether this will justify U.S. ground troops moving in now, but the Bush administration is concluding that Osama bin Laden was present during the battle for Tora Bora late last year, and that failure to commit U.S. ground troops to hunt him was its gravest error in the war against al-Qaeda. In the fight for Tora Bora, corrupt local militias did not live up to promises to seal off the mountain redoubt, and some colluded in the escape of fleeing al-Qaeda fighters. Army General Tommy Franks, who is the war's operational commander, the Washington Post writes, misjudged the interests of putative Afghan allies and let pass the best chance to capture or kill al-Qaeda leaders and Osama bin Laden. It says that Franks did not perceive the setback soon enough because he ran the war from Tampa with no commander on the scene above the rank of lieutenant colonel. I don't know if this is a setup to bring more U.S. troops into the region, but right now British forces are leading the fighting on the ground. Can you describe what is happening and the rivalries that are going on and the killings that are going on in Afghanistan now?
Well, yeah, as the person from Human Rights Watch had said, there is incredible amounts of ethnic rivalry going on between different factions of the Northern Alliance. Now, we have to just look at the history of the Northern Alliance to understand why these groups are fighting one another. These guys are simply the Mujahideen warriors who were hired by the U.S. to fight the Soviets. They've always had ethnic rivalries. I shouldn't even say ethnic rivalries. They are from different ethnic groups. So they've always had rivalries based on their little fiefdoms on controlling pieces of land. And they have constantly had these kinds of skirmishes between them. In fact, General Rashid Abdul Rashid Dostum, who was named the deputy defense minister, is the man whose men were responsible for looting and raping in the Balkh region. Now, this man has a special elite U.S. Unit with him, traveling with him at all times. The United States is working with Dostum. And the person who is sort of his rival, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, was the man who the U.S. had given the bulk of the funding in the 80s. The United States has known that these different rival groups have had rivalries. It didn't matter in the 80s because all that mattered was getting the Soviets out. And now all of this is being played out. You can see that it's almost predictable. All of it's being played out within these different groups. And Afghans on the ground have predicted and were very, very afraid when the Northern Alliance came into power that all of the history of the early 90s would be repeated during the Civil War when these groups were fighting one another. These same groups were fighting one another, killing tens of thousands of Afghans. So the instability remains very, very high. And there have been many calls for international security forces in all parts of Afghanistan. The United States has been the only country consistently refusing to allow troops into international peacekeeping troops into other parts of Afghanistan, restricting them to Kabul alone. And they've said that, well, you know, Afghanistan should have its own army, which is ridiculous. There's 300,000 armed militia men in Afghanistan who are fighting one another. The last thing Afghanistan needs are more armed men. It really needs somewhat of a bigger peacekeeping force within the country.
We are also joined on the telephone from Pakistan by Shazia. She is with RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. You have just returned from Afghanistan underground. What is the situation of women there right now?
Yeah. The situation of the woman is better than from 1992 to 1996. The women can go to schools, they can teach, they can at least go to the clinics and do, for example, the doctors can work, the nurses can do their jobs. And also the women can go to school and teach the students, and the students can go to their schools. But until they can't pick out the burqa, they still wear the burqa when they come from home to schools. But in the school, they out for their burqas and they start teaching and studying. And also the situation is quite bitter. We can't compare it from 1992 to 1996 and also during the Taliban period. It's quite bitter.
You were there in Afghanistan and Kabul in 1992 when tens of thousands were killed. What was your experience then?
From between 1992 to 1996, there was a lot of war between different groups, jihadist group.
Shazia?
Yeah.
Yes, keep going.
Yeah, between Gulbuddin and Northern Alliance. So thousands and millions of people were killed, and also there was bombing, there was war, and also and between 1992 to 1996, the looting, kidnapping, and also raping of the women from 7 years old to 20 years old women. They were raped by jihadis. They were...
Shazia, can you hear us? Go ahead.
Sorry?
Can you hear us? You were describing there was looting and bombing.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask Sonali Kohatkar a question, who is in California, vice president of the Afghan Women's Mission. In 1992, when the Mujahideen rose to power, when the president was ousted and the country descended into civil war, do you see similarities with what is happening today in Afghanistan?
Absolutely. There are a number of similarities. You have a puppet government in place today, which is essentially a government that was crafted by the United States, similar to in the early 90s when the government of Najibullah was crafted by the Soviet Union as it withdrew. Now, Hamid Karzai was handpicked by the United States. This has been reported in the New York Times. And as in the early 90s, this government today remains incredibly unstable, incredibly tenuous, simply because the major part of this government includes members of the Northern Alliance, or the Mujahideen, as RAWA refers to the jihadis. And their instability is so high, you've got rival factions within the government breaking off. Now, in the early 90s, you had these Mujahideen warriors who ousted Najibullah, the Soviet puppet, and descended into civil war. That's the kind of thing that is very likely to happen right now if the international community does not somehow intervene or more attention is not paid to Afghanistan. Groups like RAWA are predicting that the country is going to once more descend into civil war. As the person from Human Rights Watch said, the upcoming Loya Jirga process is very much being threatened. The troops of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar are threatening to destabilize this this particular attempt at some more an attempt at democracy, or a step toward democracy is being threatened. There are similarities simply because the men are the same. The men who were in power with the guns in the early 90s are the same men who are in power with the guns right now. And you know, there's nothing to say that they would be somehow suddenly changing their attitudes towards human rights, towards women. One difference is that Commander Massoud was assassinated the day before the September 11th bombings. He is missing, but apart from that, the other players remain in power. Rabbani, Dostum, Fahim, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, these are the same men who are friends with the United States, who were given millions of dollars, billions of dollars, I should say, of weapons during the 80s. I mean, this was the largest CIA undertaking in the history of the CIA's undertakings in the 80s and the 90s. So there are those kinds of similarities, and we have to watch.
And then there is the whole issue of drugs. Drugs today, with some of the greatest production of heroin coming out of Afghanistan, very different approach the U.S. is taking to Colombia as it pours more than $1 billion into military aid to Colombia, saying they're fighting the so-called war on drugs, but their allies in Afghanistan. What is the history of drugs, the U.S. government, the CIA, and Afghanistan, and why there is such a heavy drug production, especially in the northern areas?
Well, Afghanistan has always had drugs coming out of it. It has always had poppy cultivation and opium production, but it was really increased and encouraged and fostered by the CIA in the 80s, because this was one covert source of funding for weapons and military training in the 80s. And so the CIA played a great hand in encouraging the growth of poppies, encouraging drug flows to fund the covert wars in the 80s. Now, when the Taliban came into power, they continued this tradition, but the U.S. took a very different approach. It pushed sanctions on the Taliban through the United Nations to stop poppy cultivation. And in fact, the Taliban did do a lot to stop the cultivation of poppies and to stop the opium and heroin production. Under the Northern Alliance, however, during the same period that the Taliban had stopped the cultivation, more drugs came out of the region. And so, you know, you see a very hypocritical stance taken by the United States. Today, Afghanistan is back where it started. The only thing that's growing in Afghanistan are poppies. You don't see the wheat growing. In fact, the November bombing campaign by the United States disrupted the planting of grain. So today, Afghans are starving. There's a drought. They're absolutely starving. All that's coming out of Afghanistan is opium and heroin, but that's somehow overlooked by the United States. It's okay for their friends to be cultivating these drugs, but not okay when the Taliban was doing it.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Sonali Kohatkar, with the Afghan Women's Mission and Pacifica Station, KPFK. Good luck in hosting KPFK's morning show. Also, Shazia, who joined us from Pakistan, of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan. In fact, we just have a report out of Kandahar that an unidentified man threw acid on an Afghan woman teacher in Kandahar soon after threatening pamphlets appeared in the former Taliban stronghold. He threw the acid at her as she was going home from school. She was a teacher. He apparently was detained. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by a human rights activist and filmmaker who's brought some film back from Afghanistan of a family trying to deal with the aftermath of the U.S. bombing. Stay with us.
Afghanistan.
The Middle East.
India.
Pakistan.
Sierra Leone.
Zimbabwe.
Iraq.
Angola.
The Balkans.
East Timor.
Ireland.
Ethiopia.
Turkey.
Eritrea.
Kurdistan.
We are a world at war.
I think we stand for the destruction of property.
The fight against terror is an international struggle to destroy our liberty and our way of life.
Now the time has come. There's no place to run. I might get burned up by the sun. Time has come today. Time's come today.
Help turn the tide towards peace. Join us for a 6-hour live coast-to-coast program on the burgeoning mobilization for peace. Tune in to Perspectives on Peace this Saturday, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time on your local Pacifica station.
You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. There have been a number of developments in Afghanistan right now. On Monday, four U.S. soldiers were killed, one wounded trying to destroy a cache of rockets. The incident brings the number of U.S. troops killed in and around Afghanistan since the war began to 36. News today, another U.S. soldier has been wounded. Meanwhile, more than 3,000 Afghans have lost their lives in the U.S. bombing. Countless others have been killed or severely wounded by unexploded cluster bombs and mines. Estimates of the number of landmines and unexploded bombs and shells littering Afghanistan and range from 600,000 to 10 million. We are joined now by Hadi Raimi, who is an independent researcher with the Center for Economic and Social Rights, who's just completed a report on human rights and reconstruction in Afghanistan. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's very good to have you with us. Can you tell us what you found before we play some of your footage from Afghanistan?
Sure. We were asked by the UN Advisory Office for Human Rights in Afghanistan to undertake an assessment mission of the human rights needs and priorities of the Afghan civilian population for the reconstruction process. We went to Afghanistan, and during the month of January, we were there. We visited the refugee camps in Pakistan as well. And what we found basically was that, like your previous speaker said, the situation in Afghanistan is quite grave right now. And the main concerns of the population are almost everyone we talked to had four categories of concern. One was peace and security, like you were saying, the warlordism and the return to the pre-Taliban era is quite devastating for the people to see the clock turned back. And of course, the situation with the food is quite grave. Almost everyone we talked to had a problem in getting enough food, and they wanted immediate help with that. And on top of that, work and education were the other two priorities for the people in the region.
Let's go to the film that you took, Hadi Raimi, in Afghanistan. And because the people are not speaking English, if you could just translate.
Sure.
We are doing this on radio and on public access TV. And so listeners and viewers on public access TV stations and on Dish Network Channel 9415 on Free Speech TV can actually see what this family is going through.
At the time of bombing, I was asleep. We hadn't slept the night before since we were anxious and stressed. When the planes approached, our houses shook as if an earthquake was underway. I opened my eyes and saw my daughter standing by my side. I got up in shock as she screamed, "Father, I'm burning." I got up, pulled up her shirt, and saw her intestines exposed. I stepped out of the room and saw her mother with her leg bleeding intensely. I grabbed her chador off her head and tied it around her wound. I also wrapped my daughter's stomach and rushed them to the hospital. I got back home around 5 o'clock, and only then I was informed that my brother and many others were killed. In total, 11 people died and 13 were injured. It was an extremely powerful bomb that destroyed everything in its path. Someone came here to detonate the unexploded bomblets. I was so angry, I told him that the bomb is a terrible act against humanity. Why did you make it? Look what it's done to our neighborhood. I can see that this bomb was made in 2001. How is it that you come from England and are so familiar with this bomb? He laughed and admitted that he knows how to build them. I asked him that when you build this, didn't you tell those people who would be using them that it is made for destroying military hardware and not humans? He replied that they know, but this is a mistake. I said he has made a terrible bomb, that it is a crime against humanity. I even told him to tell Mr. Bush that whenever he's fighting a war, load these bombs onto your airplanes to destroy enemy's military hardware. This bomb is made to destroy tanks, large monster-sized tanks. Come, take a look at inside of our houses to see how it has penetrated 40-centimeter-thick concrete beams. It killed cows, turkeys, chickens, sheep, dogs, cats. Human, it's a trees ablaze. I'll show you trees with such thick trunks burnt down. It destroyed our furniture and belongings. We have lost everything. It took them all. After all is said and done, we wish that we had died instead of losing our beloved young man. We have received no assistance from the UN or the Red Cross. No help for us or our injured. Assistance? What assistance? The offices of OIM, ICRC, and another place promised to jointly help us. Their idea of help was to give us one cooking pot, 5 kilos of beans, and 5 kilos of cooking ghee that is harder to break than ice. We can't even break a piece of it with an axe. Brother, we don't need such assistance. You have bombed us, rid us of Taliban, but who is concerned with the future of these children? People of Afghanistan don't have any financial abilities. I don't have a job or any source of income. We expect that the rulers who made the decision for taking the life of this children's father, they should also be held accountable to provide for these children's future. Otherwise, if no one pays any attention to our plight, I'll be forced to take them to the outskirts of the city, give them to Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders to bring them up. I can't possibly afford to provide for them, and I have no patience left.
That report, a video that has come out of Afghanistan, filmed by Khadi Gaimi, who is an independent researcher with the Center for Economic and Social Rights. I can't help but think about the two bombings of the Red Cross, the U.S. bombings in Kabul. Are humanitarian aid workers able to get in? Final comment in this 60 seconds.
Well, the situation has changed. The situation was the worst when the bombing started, and during the month of October and November, the humanitarian aid workers could not reach the areas which needed most help. And as a result, in the Maslakh refugee camp, we met thousands of refugees.
This was known as the slaughterhouse camp.
As the slaughterhouse, correct. We met thousands of refugees who had left in November to come to this camp when they had become desperate and no aid was getting to them. So during the month of October and November, when aid workers could not deliver food and other assistance to these people, it was critical. And the U.S. bombing, of course, was the main reason for that not happening.
Mm-hmm. And the main call of people that you spoke to now?
Yes, peacekeeping force is very important on their mind. They have no love for any of the leaders, their political leaders. They don't want to have anyone who has been part of the conflict for the past 23 years. And they really hope that the international community will not make the same mistake as in 1990 and will not abandon them. Also, they consider the reconstruction an obligation of the international community that is owed to Afghanistan. They believe the foreign forces have destroyed this country, not them, and therefore the reconstruction of it is their obligation.
That's interesting because groups who lost loved ones at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the Campaign for Peaceful Tomorrows, as well as Global right. Exchange, are calling for a reconstruction fund for Afghanistan as money has been given to families here in the United
exactly.
States.
Exactly, and I hope that will get enough support to go through, because as it's mentioned, the government of Afghanistan, even if it wanted to provide relief to these families, it doesn't have any
cash.
Has
the international aid promise come in?
No, nothing. The donor nations have not delivered on any of their promises yet.
Khadi Gaimi, thank you for being with us. If people want to go to the website, where can they go?
Yes, they can go to www.cesr.org. And to find out about the details of the report.
And you can go to our website for all further information and contacts, and that's democracynow.org. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
You can also email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Tomorrow we'll continue to look at what happened in Venezuela. Juan Gonzalez will be joining us with the attempted coup. What role did the United States play in that of Hugo Chavez? I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! Wake up!